From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, October 10, 2008. Top world leaders meet in Washington to discuss the financial meltdown. We'll go to London and hear how European governments are reacting to the global crisis. And if you're thinking about going to the ballot box come November, you might want to make sure your name hasn't been eliminated from the rolls.
In fact, they are purging folks all over the country from the voter rolls. You ask, is it legal? Well, sort of and sort of not.
I'm Aura Bogado. Stay tuned for that and more after this news.
Here are the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. I'm Jess Burns. The Connecticut Supreme Court ruled today in a 4-3 decision that same-sex couples may marry. Melinda Tuhus reports from New Haven.
Connecticut legalized civil unions for same-sex couples in 2005, but many advocates have been pushing for the right to marry. Ann Stanback, director of Love Makes a Family, said this victory was 8 years in the making.
It is a historic ruling. I think that the court said very clearly that civil unions are a separate and unequal status. And I think people will be getting married before the end of this year, for sure.
The ruling in Kerrigan and Mock et al. Versus Department of Public Health came 17 months after the case was argued at the state Supreme Court. Connecticut joins Massachusetts and California as the only states allowing full marriage rights for same-sex couples. For FSRN, I'm Melinda Tuhus in New Haven.
Activists in St. Paul, Minnesota, announced a lawsuit today against the city over a police home raid just prior to the Republican National Convention. Michael Whalen is seeking $250,000 in damages. According to lawyers, armed guards prevented Whalen and his house guests from leaving his duplex while police sought a search warrant. Several members of the independent media in town to cover the convention were staying at the residence. Zimbabwe's president, Robert Mugabe, agreed today to allow mediation to re-energize the stalled unity government talks. This comes after the country's annual inflation rate reached a new level of 231%. That rate is the world's highest, and it's largely blamed on bad economic policies implemented by the country's leaders. Davidson Makanga reports from Cape Town.
Economists say only a speed political solution forming a unit government can stop the trend. Basic commodities and services are now officially traded in United States dollars because the local currency has lost value. Commentator Philip Pasurai says political stability would open the much-needed credit lines with monetary institutions such as the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. He also called on regional blocs to push for progress on the recent power-sharing deal.
The United Nations and the African Union must take an active role, and not to refer to them as a mere reference group, which does not have the powers.
Meanwhile, Movement for Democratic Change leader Morgan Tsvangirai blamed the deadlock in unit government talks on political rivals ZANU-PF. Former South African President Thabo Mbeki is expected in Zimbabwe this week to revive the dialogue. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Davidson Makanga in Cape Town, South Africa.
In Mexico, a two-month-long strike by public school teachers in the state of Morelos came to a head this week with three separate and major crackdowns against the teachers and their supporters. The teachers began their strike to protest a series of reforms they say privatize the school system and eliminate job security. Shannon Young has more on the story.
An estimated 1,500 Mexican soldiers and federal riot police used tanks, helicopters, and tear gas to storm the small town of Jojocotla, Morelos last night. Their stated aim was to break up a blockade on a federal highway that teachers and parents of public school students had been maintaining for the past week and a half. It was the third major operation this week to squash the teacher strike that has prevented the start of the 2008-09 school year in the state. The strike has garnered the support of parents and students in a number of indigenous towns, particularly in Jojocotla. In response to the crackdowns, the Morelos teachers lifted their tent city encampment from the central plaza of the state capital and took it to Mexico City. Teachers from the states of Oaxaca, Michoacán, and Tlaxcala are also on their way to the capital to join the protest outside of the headquarters of the Secretary of Public Education. For FSRN, I'm Shannon Young in Oaxaca City.
The Taliban and other extremist groups continue to step up attacks on U.S. supporters in Pakistan. They are targeting the Pakistani army, government officials, and members of local tribes who are resisting the militants' efforts to control the region. From Pakistan, Afridi Afridi has the latest.
Sources on the ground say a suicide bombing today killed approximately 100 people at an ongoing Jirga or tribal meeting in the Orakzai Agency. In a visit last week to the area, FSRN observed that the hospital does not have the doctors or capacity to deal with such an emergency. The number of deaths may increase as hundreds of people attended the meetings. This is the second time an anti-Taliban jirga has been targeted. Strategically, the centrally located Orakzai Agency is very important. Without control there, the Taliban would lose key access points to other tribal areas of Pakistan. For FSRN, I'm Afridi Afridi.
And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. I'm Jess Burns.
As the Dow Jones reaches its lowest point in 5 years, global markets are also struggling, and President Bush is set to meet with members of the G7, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Bank this weekend in Washington. At issue, the nationalization of U.S. and global banks, and how other nations are responding to the U.S. financial crisis. Karen Miller has more.
Speaking at the White House, President Bush attempted to calm the stressed American public. He said the U.S. is not isolated and pointed to a global economic problem.
We've seen that problems in the financial system are not isolated to the United States. They're also affecting other nations around the globe. So we're working closely with partners around the world to ensure that our actions are coordinated and effective. Through these efforts, the world is sending an unmistakable signal. We're in this together, and we'll come through this together.
The U.S. and central banks in Europe coordinated an interest rate cut earlier this week. Unified discussions are now revolving around the possibility of nationalizing or government takeover of some private banks. The United Kingdom's government is already taking steps, and U.S. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson has hinted that the U.S. could be moving in that direction. Thomas Ferguson is professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts. Ferguson supports the idea.
They've got to do something. It's obvious that the financial world is collapsing in on them. And you can now see the international pressure becoming very strong since the British actually did it. When you have a bank financial crisis of this sort, what you need to do is inject capital into the banks. Capital's the cushion that banks use to ride out trouble.
Once the institution gets up and running again, you can sell the shares and recover the money. Ferguson says the taxpayer must benefit. The government must have voting power and must be able to sell shares for profit when the time is right. But Ferguson says, however, that the Bush administration is indicating a plan that would benefit the banks.
The right question to ask is this sensible to do, and who benefits from it? I mean, putting a floor on some asset prices is a virtually hopeless enterprise at this point. And it's likely only, it's going to become a way in which the Treasury channels some money to the lucky banks it selects.
Secretary of Treasury Henry Paulson is also meeting with heads of the world's 20 leading economies over the weekend. Mark Weisbeck, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, says at that meeting the International Monetary Fund should promote needed changes.
The fund should be encouraging the United States and the G7 governments to do everything necessary in terms of lower interest rates and a big fiscal stimulus. And it's really necessary to tell them to do it because they're not doing it now. They haven't made any commitment to this. And in fact, the European Central Bank, and to a lesser extent the Fed, they're still worried about inflation, which is, if they're going to worry about inflation, they could end up repeating the mistakes that led to the Great Depression.
For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Karen Miller.
It has been another turbulent week in the global financial markets. European countries have experienced a rash of bailouts, differing levels of government guarantees on savings, bank mergers, and collapses in the space of just a few days. Naomi Fowler reports on how European governments are reacting.
This global financial crisis has presented one of the biggest challenges yet to the ability and willingness of the European Union and its 27 member states to make collective decisions and act in unison. President of the European Commission, José Manuel Barroso's concern was clear in his statement on coordinating EU action.
It's not just a problem of injecting liquidity. We also need to inject credibility in the European response. That is why we are asking and urging member states for a closer cooperation. It is critically important for the confidence in the markets, the credibility of our joint actions regarding the current situation. The European financial system has the ability to respond. We can have confidence in it.
But the unravelling of any kind of collective European response began when Ireland suddenly announced it would give 100% guarantees on retail deposits and personal savings for the next 2 years. Greece, Germany, Spain and Denmark followed its lead. Governments like the UK, not willing or able to underwrite their banks to the same extent, are now watching money flowing away from them into the banks of their European neighbours. Banking analyst Alex Potter.
Whilst you've got several European governments looking at guaranteeing deposits across the board, it makes life very, very hard for the UK banks and very tough for the whole financial system if our government doesn't follow suit. In totality, it would be nearing £2 trillion if they guaranteed the entire UK system. Fundamentally, banking's a confidence game. If you put that size of bet on the table, the chances of you actually being called on it and actually losing money are very, very small.
But the responsibility for a risk of that kind lies with Prime Minister Gordon Brown. He's just invested £400 billion worth of taxpayers' money in a part nationalisation of 8 major UK banks. That's equivalent to about a third of Britain's entire economic output. The deal is quite different from the US bailout, as Chancellor Alistair Darling explained to Parliament.
For all the operations of the recapitalisation fund announced today, we will be charging the banks on full commercial terms. We will hold a capital stake as part of the investment, and that will include a payment of dividends on shares and the appropriate charges for the use of the guarantee, ensuring that the taxpayer is appropriately rewarded. Mr. Speaker, in return for this offer to invest in banks, I'll need to be satisfied that the banks have the appropriate policies in place, policies to prevent the irresponsible behaviour that we've seen in some parts of the global banking system.
Broadly speaking, it appears that governments with laissez-faire relationships with their financial systems appear to be having a rougher ride than governments such as in France and Spain, who've never been adverse to state intervention in the form of legislation. Although Spain has been hit hard, it forced its banks to increase their contingency funds early on to protect themselves from the coming crisis. So far, Iceland has typified the worst possible scenario resulting from a highly liberalised and therefore high-risk banking system. Banking analyst Alex Potter again.
You saw the Icelandic currency, the krona, lose 20% of its value in 1 week alone, and we're now seeing media reports that supermarkets can't import food because people won't accept their currency. Energy companies can't import oil for the same reason. That's an economy that's going to be in dire straits in very short order.
According to economists, that's a situation that should encourage better intergovernmental consultation and coordination, rather than the panicky, isolationist approaches seen so far. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
Indian police have arrested dozens of Muslim youth in connection with a series of recent bomb attacks across Indian cities that killed more than 150 people since January this year. The police claim little-known Muslim groups are behind these bombings, but members of India's 150 million-strong Muslim community think police are indulging in a defamation campaign against the Muslim community at large. Bismillah Gilani has more from New Delhi.
This week, hundreds of protesters gathered in Delhi's Jamia Nagar area to demand police accountability. This densely populated Muslim locality has been simmering with resentment since last month, when the police killed two local youth in a shootout hours after a series of bomb blasts rocked Delhi. Riyazuddin, a local shopkeeper, says the police are harassing them.
They have been terrifying people here. We can't even step out of our homes. They question us every time we go out, even if we're on our way to the market to buy medicine. We're being questioned and frisked. They think we all are terrorists. Everyone is looked upon with suspicion.
Soon after the shooting incident at Jamia Nagar, the police claimed they busted a large terror network operating across the country. They arrested nearly 60 people, all well-educated Muslims, from working engineers to graduate students. The police say they are behind all the bombings that have killed more than 150 people in Indian cities since January this year. But the families of those arrested say they are innocent and the police are framing them. Saqib Azmi, a 23-year-old management graduate, was preparing for a job interview in government service when he was arrested. The police allegations have left his father, Nisar Azmi, shell-shocked.
The police said they'd leave him alone after he answered their questions. Instead, they took him away and for the next 14 days, they wouldn't tell us where he was. It was only after judicial intervention that we could see him. Now the police are saying he is a major terrorist and he is responsible for all bomb blasts across India. My son wanted to join the Indian Administrative Services, but now they have ruined his career.
Muslim leaders see a conspiracy behind these arrests. Dr. Qasim Rasool is a member of the All India Muslim Personal Law Board.
So many terrorist acts are happening throughout the country. Nobody knows who is behind it. But unfortunately, after 9/11, the entire blame is going on the Muslim community. And the problem is that it is not restricted to the individuals, but the entire community has been maligned. And the way the things are happening, it is something very dangerous. So what we feel is that there is a definite conspiracy in it.
But the police authorities deny these charges, saying they are just doing their duty. Karnail Singh is Joint Commissioner in Delhi Police.
We have a clear-cut policy. Anyone who has committed a crime has to be arrested. It has nothing to do with a particular community. Criminals and terrorists have to be arrested, and that's exactly what we have done. We have the evidence. No such incident has taken place in Delhi where the police discriminated against a particular community. They are terrorists and we have to arrest them.
The police action, however, has drawn criticism from human rights groups as well. Mehtab Mayang, convener of the Association for the Protection of Civil Rights, says the police are resorting to illegal methods.
It's not only the Muslims who are raising questions. Everyone is questioning the way the police have been functioning.
जितने भी human rights organization हैं, उनका concern है इस सिलसिले में कि ये जो तरीका है रवैया.
They have created a vicious atmosphere, and human rights groups are particularly concerned about that. Their behavior is totally illegal and unconstitutional.
लंड है वो इसकी इजाजत नहीं देते.
The Muslim protesters' demand for a judicial inquiry into the killings and arrests have found support from a major political party. The Samajwadi Party, which is a crucial ally of the ruling Congress Party, has said if the police are found guilty in a judicial inquiry, they will reconsider their support of the government. For FSRN, this is Bismillah Gilani from New Delhi.
Maricopa County, Arizona is one of the fastest growing counties in the nation, and for the last 16 years, it's been home to Sheriff Joe Arpaio, the self-described toughest sheriff in America.
So everybody in this world knows who this sheriff is, and anywhere you go, just say you're from Arizona. Oh, you know the sheriff. That's the guy with the tents and the pink underwear and the chain gangs. Now they're going to say that's the sheriff that's cracking down on illegal immigration.
But resistance to Sheriff Arpaio's tactics is building, and residents are fighting back.
Well, what I have seen here has divided the community totally.
It's really too bad because it's really dividing the community horribly. It's really making racism just a horrible thing again.
It's kind of strange. To say the least.
Again, it's really a situation where that it's created on one sense a fear in the community.
It's no longer on the other hand, a political thing. It's us finding ourselves in a situation where We have to fight for what's right. We have to fight for what our community thinks is right.
Tune in to FSRN next week when we start a special series on what some people are calling a human rights crisis forming in Arizona. If you're planning on voting in the upcoming election this November, you may want to double check and make sure your name is on the rolls, especially if you live in a swing state. According to a study of state and Social Security records assessed by the New York Times, tens of thousands of otherwise qualified voters have been purged from the rolls or have been prevented from registering. Uprising Radio's Sonali Kolhatkar spoke with Brad Friedman of bradblog.com, a popular site devoted to voting integrity. Friedman says there is serious cause for alarm.
People should be worried, and they should not only be worried, but they should take action to do something about it, to make sure, even if they just voted in the primaries, that they call their county or their state, make sure they are still registered, because, yes, in fact, they are purging folks all over the country from the voter rolls. You ask, is it legal? Well, sort of and sort of not. The Help America Vote Act of 2002 put in this mechanism in place, required states to completely computerize their voting rolls. Prior to this, it had been a county-by-county situation. Now it's the entire state has been computerized. And what do you know? They have outsourced that project for these computerized statewide voter rolls to the same voting machine companies who did such a lousy job with the voting machines. So Diebold, ESNS, Sequoia, Hardiner Civic, and some other private companies are now managing the voter rolls. And we saw in the primary elections, week after week this year, people would show up to the polls. They were registered. They thought they were registered. And when they got there, suddenly they were no longer registered, or their registration had been changed from Democratic to Republican.
Now, this is happening in 19 states. Are states taking it upon themselves to do this?
It's happening in at least 19 states. And that's the problem with privatizing the rolls. You don't have the public oversight. But now, in addition to that, Help America Vote Act required that states and counties purge voters, supposedly deadwood, people who have died or had moved, you know, from the rolls. But because there's little or no oversight to the management of these voter rolls, people are being dumped by the thousands. And this week, New York Times came out with a report, startling report. They did an investigation that it turns out a lot of the new registrations are also being knocked out because states and counties, depending on where they are using Social Security information, which is not always necessarily accurate. They're going to those Social Security database to try to compare, you know, if my name is Brad Friedman in, on my registration form, but it's Bradley Friedman on the Social Security database, they may knock out my registration entirely. Now, they're only supposed to go to the Social Security database if they can't confirm I am who I say I am
in case of
fraud. Another way.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Supposedly in case of fraud. Mm-hmm. But these guys are breaking the law when they're doing that. When they're going to the Social Security database first, they're supposed to use other means that are far more accurate. They're not. And I'm afraid we're going to have what I've been calling a November surprise. Mm-hmm. When people show up on Election Day and find out thousands, if not millions across the country, just aren't even registered.
Sonali Kolhatkar spoke with Brad Friedman about states purging voter rolls. You can hear the entire interview on uprisingradio.org. FSRN reporter Max Pringle examined yesterday the impact of the dwindling economy on day laborers, finding that many job opportunities are drying up. The hardest hit among day laborers are the most vulnerable immigrants, working class families with little or no savings, those with chronically ill children and single mothers, as well as recent immigrants. After months in debt or looking for work, those with ties to Mexico are looking back south to alleviate their financial struggles and to tap into social networks to help them through rough financial times. Today in our continuing series, Victoria Martinez looks at the recent phenomenon of reverse migration.
The San Isidro trolley station is full of ads for paycheck loans, a new pawn shop service, and a practically vacant mall. Aurelio Jaime is here to take the trolley to a job interview, 12 such interviews since he was laid off 5 months ago. Jaime has been living in California for over 20 years, always working as a cook or a waiter. But now, he is taking an unemployment check, not being able to support his wife and 15-year-old daughter.
I have been here for 20 years, and this year has been the hardest I've experienced. The hardest of all, I tell you.
Aurelio considers going back to Mexico, the land he left when he was just 20 years old. The American dream, for many Mexicans, is over. According to the August report for Mexico's Central Bank, remittances have fallen 4.2% this year, the biggest fall since they started following remittances in 1995. Analysts say the main reason is the fall of the construction and housing businesses, a niche where an estimated 20% of all Mexican immigrants were working on before the mortgage crisis. Dr. José María Ramos is a border dynamics expert from Colegio de la Frontera Norte, a social think tank in Tijuana, who agrees reverse migration has been trickling back to Mexico.
If there are still some job opportunities for undocumented immigrants, those opportunities are for immigrants that have been here 4 or 5 years. They are more likely to stay. Those who might be going back are immigrants arriving to the United States for the first time, who have little community ties and therefore might find it harder to stay.
There are no numbers yet as to how many people are migrating back. But Mexican consulates in Texas reported a high in the number of Mexicans asking for school transcripts to be translated to Spanish so their kids can get into schools in Mexico. But it's not just the recent immigrants who are now in trouble. 27-year-old Rosario Castarena is a second-generation Mexican-American. She doesn't have a job and is asking for change in order to buy diapers for her 4-year-old autistic son.
I've been thinking of going to clean the freeway, sweep the street, be a volunteer, anything to get the county to help me because you know what? I can't find the way out. I have 3 kids, I'm a single mother, and I can't afford the rent. That's why I'm moving to Tijuana. I can't afford the rent here.
Castarena has been asking for welfare and food stamps she hopes to start receiving next month. She applied for Section 8 housing, but was told in San Diego County the process can take 6 to 8 years before she can move into a unit. Castarena's American dream is over. From San Diego, California, this is Victoria Martinez for Free Speech Radio News.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News, which is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. You can send us your feedback by emailing us at comments@fsrn.org. Our newscast is produced by Catherine Comp and Vinod K. Joes. Our Washington, D.C. editor is Leanne Caldwell. Our headlines editors, Nell Abram and Jess Burns. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Rose Katapchi and Oscar Hernandez. From Pacifica Station, KPFK in L.A., I'm Aura Bogado.